Okay,
you ready? Why do you think it'll be funny?
We're recording now. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, Adam Roberts. And I'm here, as always, with my delightful husband, Craig Johnson.
Hi, everybody.
And hope you're having a good day. Craig and I had lunch together today.
It was very romantic.
We went to Sugarfish, which is Craig's... Is that one of your favorite places to have lunch?
You know, I'd say it's one of the most reliable places for lunch. Because it's very easy. They have these set sort of sushi menus, literally called the Trust Me or the Trust Me Light. The implication being that you're just trusting the restaurant to make your sushi decisions for you. And it's all very tasty and reliable and consistent. And the sushi is of pretty good quality.
I didn't think it was so good today.
Ooh,
I thought it was, we got one piece of sushi was like ice cold, like straight out of the freezer.
I didn't think it was that bad. I don't know. It was a little colder than normal.
I think it's good.
They're remarkably consistent. If that was the case, that is the first time I've ever experienced a cold piece of sushi. And that's not really a deep criticism.
And you promised me they'd have miso soup and they didn't have it.
Oh, I forgot about that. They don't have miso soup.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a good, reliable, like just place to go.
Well, and it's franchised out. I mean, they opened them up in New York and I guess they're hugely popular in New
York.
Are
they?
Yeah.
It got zero stars in the New York Times.
Well, that's, I think, perhaps a little bit of a snobby reaction to a very popular franchise. It is kind of a franchise. I mean, it is a franchise, literally.
Well, sushi making is an art.
Oh, gee. Thank you. Thank you, Jiro. Or Jiro.
Jiro. I don't know. I mean, there was something today where I was like, for this amount of money, look, I mean, if it was cheap in a franchise, I would think of it one way. But it's not cheap. It was expensive to have sushi there for lunch.
No, it's not cheap. Sushi, I'm skeptical of cheap sushi.
No, but I'm saying if you're going to spend money on sushi, why wouldn't you go to like a really good sushi place?
Because this is mid-range. This isn't like the high-end really good, which is break the bank, not affordable, expensive.
Well, I don't want to cite too much. Wonderfully too early in this podcast.
I didn't think we were having a fight. I thought we were having a discussion.
But one thing that maybe we should talk about, which is part of your motivation to have sushi today, was that something happened to you recently when you went to the doctor.
You're making that sound.
What happened? Do you want to tell everybody?
Well, I had my cholesterol checked and it is monstrously high.
You're very high,
really
cholesterol.
High cholesterol. Like shockingly high. Like the kind of cholesterol you would expect from like a morbidly obese smoker who lives off Big Macs. So it was shocking. I was surprised. And because I'm maybe not the healthiest eater in the world, but I eat pretty well. I basically eat what you eat.
I know. It makes me feel like I have Munchausen syndrome where I'm like secretly poisoning you with my food so I can take care of you when
I wouldn't put it past you.
I mean, it is funny because I do think that the things that I learned about cooking and making food delicious are also the things that as I get older, I'm like, oh, those are the things I have to stop doing if I want to actually not have high cholesterol.
Yeah, but this doesn't account for how high my cholesterol was. And the doctor said, point blank, said this seems like it's likely genetic. And so I actually talked to my parents today. And sure enough, there is a deep history of high cholesterol with my parents mm-hmm. on both sides of my family. And so that I think accounts for some of it. So I could, of course, always improve my lifestyle. I could always eat healthier. I'm relatively active. I know you make fun of me because I don't exercise as much as I probably should.
I don't make fun of you. I make fun of you because you say I like to take hikes.
To take hikes,
but you don't ever take hikes.
I take hikes occasionally.
No, you say that you take hikes as your form of exercise, and you don't actually.
I
take
like
hikes.
Saying that to you because you always get so triggered, and you have a reaction just like you're having right now.
Well, look,
the point is,
what's your point?
Well, is that high cholesterol can be genetic amongst everything else. It's not entirely that.
Right.
I'm sure I could get my numbers down if I switched up my diet a little bit, stopped having the Terry Gross sandwich.
The sandwich that he talks about all the time on this podcast.
It's so delicious.
We actually got into a fight the other day when he got his results, and I was like, you have to stop eating that sandwich.
I was eating a Terry Gross sandwich
and he was like, what do you mean? This is totally fine, but it's like a giant, bready, enormous sandwich filled with like mayonnaise, coated coleslaw, and all
cheese
kinds of cheese.
It's a delicious sandwich.
It probably has the amount of cholesterol for like somebody's full day of eating in one sandwich.
I don't think that that's probably true. It is not a cholesterol-free sandwich.
So we're not trying to judge here.
Oh, whatever. Yes, that's your number one profession.
It's not being judgmental. It's just pointing out that if you want to lower...
For me, you like judging what I eat. I always hear about what I eat.
No, I like to analyze what you eat. I don't like to judge it.
Okay, we'll let the audience decide.
But, you know, I myself had high cholesterol like 2 years ago, and I went to this doctor who kind of shamed me about it and made me feel terrible. And that's actually the period of time when my lunches started to change. I mean, this is lunch therapy. And around that time, I joined a gym and I started going. I would basically write in the morning and then I would go to the gym and exercise and shower at the gym.
Well, you eat in the morning. Let's
I would have like a little yogurt and granola, like a light breakfast. And then I would go to this gym and I would run for 30 minutes on the treadmill and, you know, do 3 miles and be covered in sweat. And then I'd shower and then I'd have a smoothie. And because they had smoothies at the gym.
You are so LA.
And, you know, it's funny. The idea of eating a smoothie for lunch just felt so paltry and just so depressing. Like, oh, my God, you know, am I really going to eat smoothies for lunch every day? But I did. And I just got used to it. I think it's also about routine and getting used to a routine. And my cholesterol went down significantly. It went from 133 LDL to 99 LDL, which is below where, you know, it's a good place to be.
You're supposed to be under 100.
Under 100.
For your LDL, which is the bad cholesterol.
Yeah.
But it's more of a balance between your bad cholesterol and your good cholesterol, which is supposed to be a higher number. The higher the number, the better.
You had very high LDL.
I did. We're not revealing numbers.
Okay.
But I did. It was shockingly high. Yeah. I know it's crazy. It was actually crazy. It was really unsettling because I never eat fast food. I never eat packaged commercial food. I don't snack, you know, like trans fat and that kind of stuff that really gives you.
Sorry for
Adam's,
coughing.
Adam's getting over a sickness. Yeah. But I don't smoke. I don't do any of the things that really...
You do snort cholesterol, though.
Well,
so that's
everyone's entitled advice.
Well, I'm glad that you found out when you did, though, because I think being, you know, still relatively young...
Oh, gee, thank you.
And then, no, you are relatively young.
Relatively young.
But to be able to identify this now and be able to address it now, as opposed to people, so there's lots of people out there who don't want to get their cholesterol checked, who don't go to the doctor. So if you're listening to this and you're one of those people, go find out.
Especially if there's a history of heart disease in your family and find out if your parents have high cholesterol or your relatives do, because there can be a genetic component to it.
Well, this might be a nice transition to this cookbook that I have in front of me. It's called Apple, Recipes from the Orchard. And I guess it's a nice transition because there's some beautiful, you know, delicious desserts in here and pies
apples,
and cakes.
Apples, low cholesterol.
Yeah, apples are low cholesterol. So this cookbook, Apple, Recipes from the Orchard, is written by James Rich, who is a British man who was visiting LA, and he sent me a message that he was a fan.
Such a specific description. He is a British man.
It's funny because I'm like holding this book about the author, because I wanted to say like specifically that he grew up on an apple orchard. He's a cider maker's son. He's from Somerset. And he's a really cool guy. But basically what happened was he sent me a message to say he was a fan of my podcast. I said, oh, if you're ever in LA, you should come on. And he's like, well, I am in LA. I'm in Palm Springs. I guess that's not LA, but he's like, I'm in Palm Springs. I'll be back in LA. I'd love to come on. So he came on. And so what you're about to hear is my interview with James Rich, the author of Apple, Recipes from the Orchard. Before we get to that, though, as always, if you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, just type in Lunch Therapy on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, hey, give us a review. It's a nice thing to do. All right. Well, go get your doctor's appointment on the books to get your cholesterol checked. And now, without further ado, here is my interview with James Rich. Okay, well, James, so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize this, but when people come over for the podcast, as you just experienced, I just drag them immediately into this
room. Yeah, there's no chat.
Yeah, there's no getting ready. So, but I feel like I want to just capture this initial energy.
Yeah, well, it's really, I'm really excited to be here. I'm a big fan. So.
Well, thank you. Well, it's been so funny because I became aware of you recently because you have this gorgeous new cookbook, which I'm holding up, even though this is an audio experience, but it's called Apple, Recipes from the Orchard. And already it's getting so much buzz. I mean, I was just reading, I think Celia Stack from Omnivore Books says this is one of her favorite books.
I'm so blown away by that. So
yeah.
I did an event with Celia a few weeks ago in San Francisco, and she was just so nice and has been so supportive. And yeah, it kind of gives me the jitters thinking about that. But
she's so nice. Yeah, I've loved her for a long time. And her store, did you go to her store yet?
Yes, yeah, I did the event at her store.
Oh, you did
the event,
sorry.
I did
the talk, yeah. No, that's one of my favorite stores.
Yeah, it's so great, isn't it? And the books in there are amazing.
Although it's dangerous because I spend way too much money. Yeah. Okay, so I feel like I have a lot to ask you. Now, you know this is going to ultimately be a therapy session. I'm going to be dissecting your entire psychology.
Yeah, I'm not nervous at all.
Yeah, and laying you bare on the table. You're going to be sobbing by the end of this.
Oh, no?
Okay. But the first 10 minutes, I feel like we should... Okay, I need some just like background information.
Sure.
Here's what I know about you. You're British?
I am,
okay,
yes.
The accent didn't give it away.
Damn it.
You grew up in an apple orchard?
Yeah, so I grew up in a place called Somerset in the UK, which is in the southwest, and it's really famous there because it's countryside, and it's really famous for cider, hard cider as you call it here in America, so with alcohol in it.
Okay.
And my family have a cider farm there, and we have orchards, and so I kind of grew up in and around that area and surrounded by these like gloriously abundant orchards at this time of year. And my dad's the head cider maker, so he's in charge of making all of the apple juice and the hard cider there.
No, I feel like this could be like in my mind, it either sounds like the most magical place to grow up in the world, or it could be like, there's also like a dark, like fairy tale version where like it's terrifying and like you're in the woods at night and someone's chasing you. I mean, what was it like?
A bit of both. I find it magical. So, Somerset is famous for three things, in my mind. One is cider.
Okay.
So check, got that one. The second thing is Glastonbury Festival. I don't know if you know of Glastonbury Festival.
It sounds good.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's, a really huge music festival we have in the
Okay.
I think it's like the biggest one in Europe or something like that. But Glastonbury itself is really old, and it's known as kind of like the home of King Arthur and Avalon and all of that.
Oh.
So it's all very magical. So
it is magical.
It does have that sense. And then the third thing is cheddar cheese. So I went to I went to school in Cheddar.
Really?
So those are the three things it is known for. And yeah.
How does now I've had English cheddar and it's incredible. It almost tastes like white chocolate, right? It's like so rich and sweet. And what do you think of American cheddar? And there's no right answer to this.
So I am used to really old traditional cheddar in the UK, which you actually find it difficult to get in the UK now, but that's really kind of crumbly and very, very, very tangy.
Mm-hmm.
Almost to the point that when you eat it, you're like, oh, you kind of like, you're taken aback by it. And it has like, it's even formed like crystals and things inside of it because it's unpasteurized. So,
and that's one of the most incredible things to bite into.
It's just amazing. It's so strong, and you serve it with things like, you know, onion and really strong other flavors, and it's just amazing. So the cheddar you have here is, and you have like a stronger cheddar, but it's not quite like the stuff we have at home.
That was a very diplomatic. You could be a diplomat if you wanted to be. Okay, so I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I did look at a map and to see where you were from, and it's sort of the southwest area of England. So, was it near the water?
Yeah, so it's coastal.
Okay.
So Somerset is a huge county, but it's and a lot of kind of agriculture and fields and things like that. But it's also coastal, and it's kind of on a bit of a an estuary going up to Bristol and kind of connecting with Wales. But so it's coastal. We've got loads of fields, and it's also below sea level where I live, so it gets flooded and things like that.
And is there a rivalry with like Wales? I mean, where you're from is there
good
feelings towards the Welsh?
Good feeling. I mean, I'm half Welsh or quarter Welsh or something.
Okay.
So yeah, good vibes.
I never know with like all that stuff. I mean, obviously like Ireland is across the water and there's all kinds of history there, so it's like I never quite know with, I mean, the rich complicated history
of it's very
England,
complicated,
right? That, like where people are from seems to be important,
but. Yeah, it's super important, and or it has traditionally been super important, and it's really strange because obviously I'm not going into politics, but the political climate over there at the moment is, I think, kind of igniting some of those conversations again where there were rivalries before, which I think is a real shame. And obviously with the whole Brexit thing and the Northern Ireland and the Republic border, that's kind of coming up again. And it's very uncomforting because it's, you know, we're one big happy family sort of thing.
Yeah. When you said politics, I thought you were talking about Meghan Markle.
Oh, wow. No, that's another, I wouldn't dare talk about that.
Because, I mean, that's my politics that I'm engaged. No, it's actually fascinating because I used to fantasize about moving to Europe because I thought it was so progressive and so much more sophisticated than the US, especially like London was always a fantasy of mine. Mm. But with everything that's happening, it feels like it's mirroring, like everything that's happening here is sort of being mirrored or vice versa.
Yeah, I think so. Like the UK and US, it's funny how we're kind of almost taking the same path in a way. Mm-hmm. It's very disturbing. I think that you say progressive, but like only recently we got equal marriage in Northern Ireland, which is a part of the UK, part mm-hmm. of my country,
right?
Where, you know, we had marriage in gay marriage in Wales, Scotland and England a few years ago. So mm-hmm. You know, and over here it's all 50 is it all states now?
Yeah, well, it's national because the Supreme federal. Court passed legislation that made it so that everywhere has to acknowledge gay marriage.
Yeah. So you say progressive, but actually there's certain areas that we kind of fall down on a little bit or have done up until recently.
Well, it's interesting. I'm also fascinated in like kind of the way the food culture in England has changed in terms of progress. Cause I actually spent a summer when I was in college way back when at Oxford for the summer. Mm-hmm. And I just remember the food there being terrible at the time. This is in 2003, I think.
Yeah.
And I literally would go to the Starbucks across the street from the dorm and then like eat like egg salad sandwiches. But what's cool is I feel like the reputation for British food had always been terrible. I mean, that was the joke. It was terrible. And then somewhere along the way, it was like Jamie Oliver, Nigella Lawson. I mean, does that narrative feel true to you, or was it always better than people thought?
I think it's always better than what people thought. And I think we got given a really bad reputation by our, you know, the other European countries that have a slightly different food culture, like the Italians and the French and the Spanish and things like that, which I all actually absolutely love. And I think that the British food, like we are generally a cold country. So the food that we have is much more kind of hearty and, you know, root vegetables do really well there. And
bubble
things like
and
that.
Squeak.
I love bubble and squeak.
Is that mashed potatoes with sausages in
it? So we have bubble and squeak every Monday.
Okay.
So we have a big roast dinner on a Sunday.
Wow.
And then all of the leftovers get put into a bubble and squeak on a Monday. And fry in a skillet. You basically mash everything up, put it all in together and fry it. And it is divine. I love it.
So these traditional English dishes, would you say that they just got a bad rap because people had bad versions of them?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in the UK, food perhaps wasn't taken seriously as maybe kind of like a creative outlet. It was a very functional thing. Whereas I think that in other countries, they acknowledged that food can be this amazing creative outlet that you can do all these wonderful things with, and the result not only looks really good, it tastes really good too.
Yeah.
And I think we were probably really slow to catch up on that in the UK, and it was very kind of like, you know, post-war, very functional, and you just needed to feed your family and kind of get that done before you even thought about anything beyond that. And then I think in the last couple of decades, that's completely changed in the UK, and we've got I'm close to, and I've worked in a place called Bristol, which is in the southwest as well, and that has an incredible food culture there. Lots and lots of different cultures coming together, and the food scene there is amazing. And I live in London now as well, and,
And
the food there is just—it's amazing. You know, we have people like Ottolenghi who completely changed the food landscape when he started doing his thing a few years ago. So I love the food.
Yeah.
Scene in the UK, and I love the old stuff as well, which is getting reimagined in some restaurants, which is fun. But yeah, I'm flying the flag. So
no, I mean, I have to say, like, I should say, like, my favorite food writers are all British, like Nigel Slater, Nigella Lawson, anyone with Nigel in their name. But there's something about British food writers who I think they're just so warm and personal, but smart and educated. You know, there's just like this perfect balance.
It's really interesting. Like being in the States, I'm on a book tour at the moment, and speaking to people who buy a lot of food. food books, and they tend to say that over here, that the UK writers are some of their favorites. And just name drop a little bit, but Nigella tweeted my book when it came out on the publication day.
My gosh,
completely blew my mind. I love her.
She's amazing. I mean, her language about food is so fun to listen to. I mean,
it is. It's playful, isn't it?
It's playful, but it's kind of sensual. I mean, it's almost like reading like a dirty romance novel when she's describing tiramisu or something.
All the time.
It's my favorite. I mean, she's like luscious, and like everything that she says is just so. Yeah. Her word choices are just fantastic. She's even amazing. As I'm like describing them, I'm like, my words aren't even nearly as good as
her. Yeah, same. When I was writing the book, I kind of thought, well, you know, I have to be able to, what's the right word? You know, just kind of, I'm going to be on the shelves alongside people like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't, you've got these people like Nigella and also Diana Henry as well.
I love her.
Yeah. Who just write in such amazing verses. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try and do that. And I just kind of gave up in there because it was too much pressure to try and replicate that. And what my editors were saying is that no, forget all of that. You need to kind of find your own voice and you need to write in your own style.
Sure.
And that's what people relate to. And so... Yeah, I was going crazy trying to be like, I want to be like Nigella.
Well, in terms of getting to your own voice and finding out more about you as a person, I feel like the moment has come to ask you.
Yes.
you look like a deer in headlights. What did you have for lunch today?
So I was hoping to go to Squirrel.
Oh, sure.
Which I've not visited before, and that was on the cards. However, I came from Palm Springs this morning, so I had a bit of a journey to get to LA, and the LA traffic did its thing.
Of course.
So I went around the corner from here to a place called Dune.
Dune Falafel.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite places.
Yeah, yes. And I had a flatbread hummus plate with some chicken. So, and it was like pickled turnips and olives and pickled red onion as well.
You did very well. That's
absolutely divine.
Yeah, that's a great choice.
Yeah, it was great.
How did you hear about it?
I didn't. I drove past it.
Oh, really? It's so funny because I'm planning it. My husband and I are going to Tokyo for New Year's.
Oh, wow.
And I'm driving myself crazy because I'm like researching everything and the best ramen and the best udon and I'm like, I'm going to make like a Google map, but like, it's nice to hear that you literally just drove past it and were like,
well,
I'm gonna eat there.
I'm here with my now fiance and
congratulations. I was drinking water when you said that, but I want to say congratulations more quickly.
Thank you. Yeah, we got engaged last week, so
exclusive,
so super new.
It happen in California?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, in Palm Springs in this hotel there. Yeah, sorry, sidetrack.
We'll go back to that because that's good.
Okay. So we usually, like, we have spreadsheet, we do the Google Maps thing. Yes. Like, we're very organized. He is a big, big foodie and has been to LA quite a bit. And so he was very keen to kind of explore some of the new restaurants that have opened recently. So we were all very organized and he'd actually been to Squirrel before a couple of times, I think, and I hadn't. So I was really wanting to go there today, so didn't get to do that. But
did you even try to go? Because the thing about Squirrel is the line.
Well, that's why, no, because the traffic was so bad that I was like, oh, let's just go straight to this area and then we'll find something close by, which I was very nervous about because I wanted to make sure it was a really good lunch.
Oh, yeah. Representative of you.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny because Squirrel, I mean, this is one of the most obnoxious things that my husband and I do, but we have a thing here called Postmates.
Love Postmates.
So we'll Postmates from Squirrel, which I always feel incredibly guilty about because it's
basically,
this poor person has no idea what they're in for and they get the order and they show up there and they wait. They have to wait like for an hour to get.
Oh, they still have to wait in the queue.
Oh, maybe they don't actually. I think you're right. I think they get to cut the line.
Do they
now?
Not get,
yeah, they do. Oh, okay,
that's really cruel.
No, this is my Jewish guilt. Like comes. I literally stopped myself from doing it. I was like, I can't put somebody through this.
I'd like to think they cut the queue because that would be quite cruel.
Yeah, I have to say, this is going to be very controversial. I really like Squirrel. I think it's very good. The experience of going there and waiting in this huge line and then getting like a bowl of like rice with like an egg on it and some lacto fermented chili paste. Yeah. I mean, it's all very delicious, but I don't enjoy the experience. I'd much rather just go somewhere where you can sit and then somebody comes over.
I completely agree. I am not British in that regard. I hate queuing.
Right.
I do not, especially for food, I do not like queuing for food.
And you shouldn't go to Squirrel.
So yeah. I was kind of prepared. I had prepared myself that there might be a bit of a queue and we had planned on getting there quite early.
Right.
But like I said, it didn't work out.
So. I actually drove past there yesterday and there was no line at all.
Oh, that's what I was hoping for.
Monday. Wait, no, yesterday wasn't Monday. Yesterday was Tuesday. Sorry. Okay, wait. So you had this lunch.
Yes.
So, okay, the first starting point was sort of what we were talking about was how fastidious you are in terms of your meal choices. I mean, mm-hmm. do you spend a lot of time thinking about what you're going to have for each meal?
Yeah.
What's your normal routine for lunch?
So, well, I'm traveling now. Traveling now. So very kind of, we have a list of places that we wanted to visit, like I said. So kind of very organized in that sense. Mm-hmm. When I'm at home, generally we'll like take it in turns, but we always cook. We always have a cooked meal for dinner, which I think is quite rare for people these days.
For dinner? Is dinner lunch?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, it can be both, but yeah, lunch.
Wait, dinner is lunch?
No, dinner is evening. Lunch is lunch, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was getting the part, because I know that, pudding is dessert, right?
Dessert, yeah.
Yeah, I know that, because I watched the Great British Baking Show, you know.
Of course.
So I know all that. Wait, so what does your partner do, or your husband, your fiancé?
Fiancé, he's a journalist.
A journalist.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he is a food and interiors journalist. So
a food and interiors journalist.
Yeah.
So he writes about food.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's actually just focusing on interiors at the moment, but traditionally he's always covered food as well. So
interiors being like design.
Design. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is your home like beautifully appointed with? Do you guys live together?
No, we don't.
Oh
so
my gosh. Sorry, I'm getting really personal already.
It's fine.
That's what people want, though. That's what they tune in for.
No, we actually don't live together quite yet. We're hoping that's going to happen imminently, and obviously, with the kind of news this week, then that is hopefully going to be sped up. His place is absolutely gorgeous. He had it redesigned a couple of years ago and it got shot for a magazine, and it was all very, very kind of, particular.
What's his name?
Pip.
Pip?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. That's amazing. You know what I love that British people do is when they talk about somebody's name, they say he's called, wait, no. What do you say? You say like he's called... When you say somebody's like, now I'm blanking on what I'm talking about. I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Oh my God, what am I trying to say? He's called Pip? No. You know what I'm talking about?
He's called Pip? His name's Pip?
Yeah, no, it's like a British... Okay, this is okay. I said I don't delete any parts of these podcasts, so I'm going to delete this part. Walk us through the proposal. We have to hear about it.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I wasn't expecting it at all. I've had a crazy busy year with the book, and he's also moved jobs, so we've kind of just been up in the air a lot. We have been working incredibly hard over the summer, and we usually kind of... Well, the last couple of years we've traveled quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so this was our like one big break. He came out and met me in LA after I did some events.
Okay.
And we have had 2 weeks together and gone to Palm Springs and spent some time in Venice and things like that. So it was all very nice. And then when we got to Palm Springs, we stayed in a new hotel called The Dive.
I don't know that one.
It's absolutely gorgeous. They only have like 8 or 10 rooms or something, very kind of small, but with a lovely pool. And he, kind of woke up on the first morning there and he'd organized breakfast in bed. And they kind of brought breakfast in and I was like, oh, like kind of just like, give me my coffee. And,
wait, how long have you guys been together?
2 years.
2 years. Okay.
Yeah. So not an incredibly long time, but
no, that's still, that's a long time.
Yeah. They brought breakfast in, and then on my tray, there was this card, he had written a note inside and, delivered it to the hotel before, as we got there, but obviously away from me. And then he pulled out these bracelets.
Oh, wow.
We didn't want to do, engagement rings. So
that's
we've
beautiful.
Done, engagement bracelets, and he's got a gold one. And I've got a silver one.
Did you see this coming at all?
No, I mean, it was on the cards. It's right. I was shocked, not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought that it would probably be next year, because this year, like I said, has just been kind of a bit mad.
Yes.
And I'd put it out of my mind as something perhaps for next year. So it was a real, real shock, but a happy one.
That's so nice. My engagement story is much less romantic. I had helped Sir Craig, my partner, I keep saying partner, whatever he is. by the way, I realize like he's called Pip is a Britishism.
He's called Pip. Oh, right. He is called Pip. Okay, yeah.
like Americans don't say that. Like, I think it's cute when British people are like, he's called blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
Like, nobody in America
I've never noticed that before.
Yeah, yeah. I hear it and I'm like, oh, that's cute. Okay. Anyway, what was I just saying? When Craig and I got engaged, it was because I helped us move to this apartment because our last apartment, the landlord sold it, so we had to move out.
Oh, okay.
So I did all this legwork. He's a filmmaker, so he was working on a movie, and I did all this work. So he was taking me out to dinner, and he's like, just so you know, this is just to say thank you for helping with the move, but this is not an engagement dinner. And I was like, okay, thank you. And then we went to the dinner, and then we had this whole conversation about getting married. And at the end, he's like, I guess we can get married. Oh, I was like, okay, great. And then we put it on Facebook, and then we got married.
Well, it's not out on there on Facebook or Instagram or anything yet.
It's on this podcast.
It's on the podcast. Yeah. So I better do something about that.
Oh, my gosh.
One of my friends messaged me, actually, and said, he was like, is it for real? I was like, yeah, it is for real. He's like, well, it's not on your social media yet, so it can't be real.
Well, it was so funny, because I said to Craig, when we got engaged, I was like, well, we have to tell our parents the next day because like otherwise this isn't real. So we called our parents and we told them and that was nice. And then I was like, maybe we should put it on Facebook. And he's like, okay. And I put it on Facebook, and in terms of like, it was like pulling the emotional slot machine. It was like all the coins kind of, it was like, it felt so good. You get so many likes and so many people message you. And it was just, oh my God, it was even better than telling my parents, I guess.
Putting it on Facebook. I love that.
And I have to say, getting married, as like cynical as my story was about getting engaged, but the wedding and having just the ceremony and the experience was truly one of the greatest things that's ever happened.
I'm really excited about it. I have traditionally not been a great marriage, a fan of marriage, not the idea of it, but the actual wedding day. I've always kind of been a little bit skeptical and just a little bit kind of not really my thing. But I can feel myself already being drawn into this, like be this like bridezilla type figure.
And you guys both care about food and design.
Yeah, exactly. So, the food is the big topic. Oh, it's a big topic whenever.
Can I tell you a secret about the food at your wedding?
Yeah, go for it.
You won't even really eat it.
Which annoys me. And I kind of want to plan it so that there's like some put aside so that we can enjoy it like the next day. But
you'll be so overwhelmed. I mean, you will literally have every person from your life there, and you'll just be... I don't do drugs, but I felt like I was like, I'd snorted and done every drug because you were just so high on all these people. And we put so much thought into the food at our wedding, and I don't remember anything about it.
High on love. I like that.
Okay, James, I feel like you're using charm to avoid the difficult job of lunch therapy.
Right.
So you're from Somerset. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to like get in because I feel like we've met now. We've known each other for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So you grew up in this community in Somerset. And was it a conservative community? Was it kind of a liberal?
Well, so if you looked at it on paper, it's a conservative area, very rural. Mm-hmm. Traditionally votes conservative, I think. It certainly has done recently. And so you'd kind of think that maybe that was a difficult place to grow up. And certainly for, you know, a gay guy growing up in the noughties and 90s and noughties, you would think that it would be quite difficult and perhaps there'd be some prejudice and just it wouldn't be a very fun thing. I couldn't wait to get out, if I'm honest, because it was really small. It's a really small place. And I have always been one of those people that's just like, oh, I want to see more, I want to do more, I want to experience different things and just kind of, you know, travel and do all of these great things. So I couldn't wait to get out. But I have to say that actually everybody was, you know, throughout my kind of coming out years were back home were really amazing and totally supportive and very encouraging of me just kind of being mature, you know, true me. And they were really lovely. And it actually surprised me because I anticipated a bit more of a backlash to it. You know, you kind of hear about these farming communities and things like that. Right. And it just being quite hard because it's very masculine and very, not necessarily, you know, they don't like change and things like that.
Sure.
And I had anticipated, and I think that's probably what I in my mind kind of worked myself up a little bit beforehand I wasn't looking forward to it. And then when it happened, everybody was just like, well, yeah, fine. And that's great.
How old were you?
I was 17.
You came out.
Yeah.
And when you talk about growing up on a cider, you said it was a cider farm. Cider farm. Were you taking part in the work of the farm?
No, so I didn't actually live on the farm. We just lived just down the road. But I would go and help my dad, you know, weekends or... or whenever he was looking after us. I've got like memories of me and my sisters running around the orchard while he's kind of pruning the trees and things like that. But we, the farm opened a restaurant when I was a teenager on site. And that's where I worked when I was a teenager and in my early 20s.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of went into the restaurant and started working for them there.
That already sounds like my favorite restaurant. It's like,
it's great.
Yeah. It's on a cider farm in Somerset. And it just sounds so romantic and
it's
great.
It's so busy as well. It's very popular.
What's it called?
It's called the Cider Press.
Cider Press. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. The Cider Press restaurant. And, it's very humble, traditional, English food, lots of like pies and big stews, and like they do the most amazing roast dinners.
Really?
With
apples and everything? Meat.
Yeah, I mean, if it's pork and things, it will be served with apples. And yeah, it's great food. Really, like, not like uber fancy, and I don't mean that in like a derogatory way. It's just like, it's just really tasty.
And was your father, was this like a family venture? Did he inherit it from his father?
No, so it's my cousin, or my dad's cousin, Jan, who inherited it from her father.
Okay.
So it's a real kind of real family business. There's multiple people in my family who work there. So she now runs it.
Okay.
Her and her husband live there, and they kind of run the business side, and my dad makes the cider and heads up the actual cider making side of it.
And what goes into making cider?
Apples.
No, I mean, like, what's the work of it? I mean, you just throw apples into like a thing and crush them?
Yeah, and then you're done. No. So it's a very natural process. So right. Around kind of September, October time, when the apples are in season, we will collect up the apples and then you press them for juice. Once you've got the juice, then you you kind of add yeast and things to it to bring out the alcohol and let it ferment, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
In these huge big barrels, and then you store them in oak vats, which help kind of mature the flavor, and you can keep it in there for up to a year, and then once that's happened, then the cider is ready to go. But you kind of take it out of the vats depending on kind of where you want the flavor to be. So you might only store it for a few weeks or a few months.
Are there different kinds of apples that you're growing?
Yes. So the old traditional, what we would call scrumpy, in the UK is a kind of a mix of cider apples, but they're very bitter.
Okay.
So the four different categories of apples, just very briefly, we've got sweet apples, which are the ones we're used to picking up in the supermarket and eating.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have sharp apples, which are the cooking apples. So okay. Things like Bramley Smith, if you've heard of that, Granny Smith even, sorry.
Right.
The stuff that's kind of, you can bite into, but it's quite sharp and you'd want to put it in a pie or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have bittersweet and bitter sharp. And those are the two categories of apples that if you bit into them, you'd really kind of recoil. And they'd be too bitter to eat and actually probably give you a sore tummy. But they are great when you juice them and you turn them into cider.
So, that's interesting, because when I've had alcoholic cider, it has that sharpness to it. That
yeah, absolutely.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to add, you know, in some ciders, they'll add sugar and things to it to sweeten it, because the natural taste is very dry.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to wines. When wines are made, the natural taste is quite dry of the grape. But yeah, the traditional cider will be a blend of different cider apples.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get single variety ones. So if it's a particularly good year, you'll get a single variety of cider, which could be like a Yarlington or a Lambrook Pippin or something like that. And that will just be one apple. And then you get fruit ciders and all sorts these days. So
when you were growing up in this environment and they were making alcoholic cider, did you get to taste it as a kid?
Yeah, of course.
Well, what did you think? Were you like, what is this stuff? Like,
yeah, I didn't really... Yeah, I mean, I was kind of around it and exposed to it from dad would bring cider home that he's kind of been mixing or playing about with, just to kind of, you know, pop it in the fridge and take a taste of it every so often to work out when it's at its best. So I was surrounded by it. I can't remember the first time I tried it. I was definitely young.
Yeah. I guess it's not as much of a taboo in England to have
not at all.
Kids drinking alcohol. Right?
Yeah. My dad always says that the fact that we were kind of exposed to it, not drinking it, but you know, we were around it. He always thinks that's why, you know, people who are exposed to it a bit younger and kind of taught about it, because he's very respectful of like at the alcohol and, you know, and obviously it can have it can have bad effects on people. That means that you kind of, you grow up with a bit of a respect for it.
Right.
And therefore you kind of know your limits. So, so I've kind of always been around it. I can't remember the first time I tasted it, but.
Did you ever get wasted on it? Like growing up, did you have a party with friends?
Yeah. So, where I'm from, we have, there are a number of cider farms, and, I remember being about 14 and going out with the kind of local guys from my school who I kicked about with. We had these kind of big kind of flagons, these big containers of cider, and getting absolutely wasted.
Oh, really? Oh, awful. So were you very popular? Because like you can get the alcoholic cider for everyone.
Yeah, I was quite popular. Yeah. Especially when I was a little bit older, when it was like, when I actually asked dad for it. Yeah.
And was he a good sport about it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you were growing up in this environment, like, did you, and you say you couldn't wait to get out, was there ever an expectation that you would take over the family business?
No, no, it was always, my dad was always really keen for us to kind of go out and you know, experience other things.
Right. And it's you and your sisters, you said?
Me and my sisters, and now my little brother as well. I have a 10-year-old little brother.
Oh,
he's very young. Called Charlie. He
called Charlie. That's what you see. He said called Charlie. Called like Charlie. Americans don't say that.
What would you just say?
His name is Charlie.
Oh, his name. Oh, okay, fine. Charlie. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's always been really keen for us to kind of go and do our own thing. And obviously, because my cousins run it, so it will be passed down to my cousin George and Molly. So it will. There was never an expectation. He was keen on us going and experience other things, and that's what we've done. We've all got me and my sisters all have different careers, but it's not to say that maybe one day we might kind of be back.
Maybe would you have the wedding there?
Maybe. I don't know. I definitely want the wedding in Somerset, and I really want a big field with a big kind of like teepee tent or something like that. It to be very kind of like relaxed and not too formal.
And I know we just met, but I want you to know I'll be very offended if I'm not invited to this wedding. I mean, this podcast is going to launch your whole career. Just kidding. I don't, you know, we have a couple of listeners. So the transition, do you mind if I ask, and this is a personal question, so you could avoid it if you want to, but how old you are?
I am 32.
You're young. Okay.
Yes. And I said it with hesitation because I don't know whether that's the thing when you hit your early 30s where you start forgetting how old you are. Uh-huh. The other day I was asked and I was like, I think I'm 31.
You have a quality where you could have either been younger or older. Like it's like
people say that.
It could have been anything. That's why I asked.
Yeah.
32. So 32. Okay. So how many years have you lived away from the home?
Oh, I moved away. I haven't really lived back there for 10 years.
So you're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
When you finally left Somerset.
Yeah. Let me think about this. Yeah. So I went and, so I went to university in Bath, which is still in Somerset. So that was that. And then I moved back home for a year or so before I then, what did I do then? Oh, yeah. Then I moved to, and I went and lived in Spain for a year in Barcelona. Oh,
how was that?
Amazing. Yeah, I'd still be there if I could, but it was
I've been to Barcelona. Great. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
What brought you, what was the reason that you went there?
My boyfriend at the time wasn't enjoying work very much. And we kind of, we'd always said we'd move to a different country. I always wanted to experience living in a different country. I remember it really clearly. It was one Christmas and he was just getting really depressed and down about going back to work on the Monday or whenever it was after the Christmas break. We have like 2 weeks off in England for Christmas. It's amazing.
That's so nice.
I know, yeah. He was getting really down about that. And I said, well, why don't we've always said about moving abroad. Let's just move somewhere, like pick somewhere. And he was like, we can't do that. And I was like, yep, we're going to move to Barcelona. And within about 3 or 4 hours that afternoon, I had set out, you know, the fact that we were going to move, the place we were going to move, when the time frame that it was going to happen. And then it happened exactly 8 months after that we moved to a different country. And it wasn't for a year. We just kind of moved thinking we would just spend as long as we wanted there. If it worked out, then we'd stand years there. If not, we could always come home. So we ended up spending 12 months there. Yeah.
And was it all pure fantasy or were there any things about it that weren't great?
Yeah. So it We went, we got on a plane with a wad of cash that we'd managed to save up, a suitcase each, and 3 nights booked in a hotel. We had nowhere to live, no jobs or anything. And that was part of the adventure for it, of it for me. So we landed and we had like 3 days to sort our stuff out. And we ended up booking another night in the hotel before we actually had a place to live. So that was great. And then we started working. And Barcelona is a very odd place because it, well, this is pre-2008, the crash. Mm. Oh, no, what was it? Was it just after? Around that time, but it hadn't taken effect is the point. The wages there were really low.
Okay.
They were kind of on a par with the rest of Spain, but Barcelona is like this amazing metropolis of a city and just has amazing lifestyle, and it's very expensive to live there. So we kind of had the wages of were very low and the living expenses were very high. So very quickly we burned through the money we'd saved up, and then we were living paycheck to paycheck, which was fine. And it
were you working as a waiter?
He was working in a school. I was actually working freelance for a company back in England for the first few months, and then I went and joined him and taught English in the school.
Okay.
So we were working together as well, and it was fine up until there was a bit of a family. My grandmother died while I was over there. Towards the end of our year there, and she it was very unexpected, and we were very, very close, and so I had a number of flights back and forth, and it was the combination of like that trauma happening to my family and me not being there. And Spain's only a 2.5 hour flight, if that, Barcelona is, to where I'm from, and so that was very kind of unsettling for me. And then because of all the expense of what I was doing, we just had no money, and it was just like, do you know what, it's been amazing. Right. We had an absolute blast.
Yeah.
Just the most fun. And we need to be back at home now. Let's go home. And
it's so good that you did that though in your 20s. I feel like that is the fantasy. It's like you get to do that when you're young.
Yeah.
Like now, like, you know, with Craig, like I'll be like, maybe we should move to Seattle because that's like where he's from. And then like I walk through it. I'm like, okay, I'll get there. I'll think it's great. I'll be excited. And then it gets rainy. And then, I'm, you know, like 3 months in, I'll be like, what am I doing here? You know, I think that you get excited. And then
it's funny. I don't know whether it's like 10 years on, but I'm getting itchy again. And I don't know. And just being here in California, I love California.
Uh-huh.
Like, I absolutely love it. The weather is exactly the weather I love, and the food scene here is incredible.
Are you going to move to LA?
No. So what I was
he's announcing it here first, folks. You heard it here.
Second exclusive. We've been talking just generally, you know, obviously being on holiday and things, and I was saying that I'm almost feeling myself wanting to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Not forever, but just like a year or two somewhere else, which would be really fun. So I think I probably will do it again one day.
So now I'm going to draw some connections here because there is almost an impetuousness, I would say, in moving to Barcelona. And then with lunch today, you kind of just stumbled upon Dune falafel, and it was great. Both were kind of good things in your life that you did, but you didn't overplan. But you planned a little bit.
Yeah. So I think the story of my life is when I plan things, they never, ever, works out exactly how I think.
Yeah.
And I'm a Virgo, so I'm kind of like controlling and not controlling, but I like to be in control and to know what's going on and be aware and plan things. And I think the times, if I look back, the times that things have either been really successful or, really fun and just like a good positive thing to do are the things where I haven't put too much thought into it.
Right.
So Barcelona, obviously moving there was amazing. And we had to put a certain amount of thought into it in order to actually be able to do it. But it was very loose. And, you know, as soon as we arrived, when we got arrived at the hotel, that was as much planning as we'd done.
Right.
And then it was like, right, where do we go from here? And it was a great experience. And likewise, like with my book, it was the idea for the book I had 15 years ago at the restaurant at the farm. When I pitched it to the publishers, I hadn't put a ton of thought into it in terms of like the structure of the book and, the complete list of recipes, the background context, et cetera. It was just kind of this nugget of an idea that I pitched to them and they really loved, which I was surprised at. And then obviously it's turned into a real thing.
Oh, and it's beautiful. But I have some questions about this. Mm. So how did you go from working for various companies and teaching to becoming a writer? Like, were you always interested in writing?
Yeah. So I worked in like marketing and PR and things like that. So, I have always been writing for other people.
Okay.
Publicizing, various other companies and or individuals. And so I've always written, but I've never had a byline. Okay. So, that was very nerve wracking. I've been really, really passionate about food and obviously working in the restaurant when I was right. younger. And, I'm from a really, really big foodie family, food and drink. My grandmother is an amazing cook. She lives in the south of Spain now. And,
really?
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
Wow.
And I go and,
is this your father's mother?
No, this is on my maternal side.
Mother's
side. So,
okay.
Yeah. So, I go down and cook with her and, we have an amazing relationship and it is all around food. Well, food and family gossip, but food food mostly.
Oh my God, I want to watch that show. Yeah. Like you going to Spain and cooking with your grandmother and it's gossiping.
I love it. It's brilliant.
What brought her to Spain?
The weather. She, when she was living in England, where we're from in England, it's very damp, very cold, very wet in the winter. Mm-hmm. She had some respiratory issues and they decided that the drier weather would suit her more, and she has absolutely flourished there. And
where in Spain is it?
It's in a place it's near Vélez, Malaga, which is if you fly into Malaga on the very south coast of Costa del Sol, the other side of that.
Okay.
So it's got the beach, it's got the mountains, it's got gorgeous weather.
I want a grandma in Spain. That sounds great. So nice.
I refer to it as my rehab.
Oh
so,
my gosh.
I go crazy in London working and all of this stuff, and then I'm like, right, I need to reset myself, and so I just get on a plane and go down.
And does she cook Spanish food or what does she make?
She cooks all sorts. So she's like probably my biggest food inspiration because she, from a very young age, she would get me in the kitchen and she would cook everything. She's very big into kind of exploring food, food culture and different cuisines. So she'd be like cooking up a curry or she would be doing something, you know, traditionally English mm-hmm. or she's really into, I introduced her to Ottolenghi a few years ago mm-hmm. and she is obsessed
now. Oh my gosh.
And she has cooked nearly every single recipe in all of his books. And he has like 10 maybe? No, maybe not quite that many, but
have you met him yet?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
I feel like you guys should know each other.
Yeah. So side story, he helped me and my partner get together.
In
a roundabout way.
How did that? Now this is the juicy stuff people want to know.
So yeah, I'm not sure. He knows the story as well. But my fiance now, Pip was.
I love that his name is Pip. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cute, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was working on an event for the magazine that he was lifestyle editor for at the time. And as part of that event, he hosted a panel with Ottolenghi. So he was interviewing Ottolenghi on stage and Helen Goh. I'm not sure if you've heard of Helen. Mm-hmm. So she wrote Sweet with him.
Oh, yeah, I have that book.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
The blueberry cake is insane. Anyway, so he was interviewing them on stage and we were only just like very, very early had met each other. And we immediately talked about food and I was saying how much I admired him, Ottolenghi. And he was like, well, I'm doing this event in a couple of weeks. Why didn't you just like come and sit in the audience? He was like, it's a reader event and stuff. And I was like, oh yeah. I'm like, are you sure? That'd be okay. And he was like, yeah, like come along, like really casual and like just sit at the back, you know?
Uh-huh.
And anyway, so I turned up very excited and I texted him and he came down and got me and said, oh, just come upstairs and you know, I'll sit you down kind of thing. And I hadn't even thought about it. And what had happened is just before I arrived, he'd said to Yotam, oh, by the way, there's this guy that I'm bringing along tonight that I'm kind of into and want to see. And he's a big fan. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of like, you know, I will introduce you. That would be right. And Yotam was fine. So I walked into the room and he introduced me and Yotam just like sidled up to me and just like completely charmed me off my socks.
Oh my gosh.
And was just the most lovely, lovely, adorable person. And I just had heart eyes coming out and was just totally overcome.
So he was Pip's wingman.
He was totally Pip's wingman.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And, so he's clearly going to cater your wedding for free.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. So you're like in this world a little bit. That's like my, you know, like I keep saying fantasy, but like, yeah, I mean like, you know, do you know Nigella personally?
No, I don't. I've never met her. I would absolutely love to meet her. But I
how did she know of you? How did she hear about your book?
So I'm not really sure. I think it's either through my publisher or again through Pip, because she follows him on Instagram and things like that. So
you're in a relationship with somebody who writes about food,
yeah.
And now you've written about food.
Yeah.
And do you guys agree all the time about food?
Funnily enough, we agree. Do you know what? Actually, yeah, we do. I've not actually thought about that before, but we like the same types of foods,
mm-hmm.
And flavors. We bonded over chicken.
So oh.
Diana Henry's Bird in the Hand is like my number one cookbook. I love
that's the that one book of hers I don't have.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. You must get it. It's
should,
really,
I've
really
seen
good.
It. I should get it. Okay.
It's great. And it has some really great recipes in there, and stories as well. But, yeah, when we met at the time, I was reading cooking from that book quite a lot, and we kind of bonded over that book. So, we do agree on the same types of food. I'm just trying to think of a time when we haven't.
Does he ever give feedback when you cook something?
Yeah, he does. He's critical, in a good way. Like he will, I've never written. This is my first book, so I've never written a book, and he obviously is published, and he was instrumental in like guiding me through this, because mm-hmm. I did not have a clue. And pulling all the recipes together and playing with the flavors, and I'd get him to taste them and he would give me some feedback, and there are a good few recipes in there are kind of a Pip, in the sense that he's kind of like added flavors or added ingredients.
Was there a recipe that you presented to Pip that he was like, no, this is just not gonna make it in the book? Or was he overall pretty encouraging?
Overall, pretty encouraging. There's one recipe that he definitely thinks should have been in the book that isn't in the book.
Oh, what's that?
And that he's told me I have to write up for my website and put out. And that is a bean sausage and cider stew.
Ooh, that sounds good.
I don't know why. I ended up having three stews in the book.
Uh-huh.
And I decided that was one too many for some silly reason. And I included the pork and the vegan option. And the sausage, obviously being pork, was kind of like I thought was quite similar to the other, so I'd kept it out, but actually right. It was really good, and I'm gonna have
you'll
to
use it next time around.
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
So is the cider that's in this book, is it the kind of, is it like hard cider that you cook with?
Yeah, it's the concept of the book is to kind of celebrating that one ingredient in all of its forms. So in okay. every recipe, there will either be apple as a raw ingredient, or there'll be cider vinegar, or cider brandy, mm-hmm. or apple juice, etc.
Do you ever make an apple pie? Like an all American apple
there
pie?
Funny enough, there's a recipe called the All American Apple
Pie.
Oh,
great.
There, and I was terrified yes. about doing it, because I have friends here in the States and I just know how much of a big thing it is. And I said to my publishers, I was like, I can't write an American apple pie recipe, because, you know, it's just, it means so much to people in the States. And they were like, oh, you know, you have to include one. I was like, fine. So I spoke to a few people over here, and I love how like protective people are here with their recipes. So it's sure. like being handed down by their mothers or grandmothers.
Right.
And they're just like, I'm not telling you what the secret ingredient is.
I don't like that. I think it's silly. I think that's old fashioned. I think like that was like before the internet, before, and it's like now recipes are just everywhere.
Just,
Craig, my husband, I keep saying my husband, it's so weird, but his favorite thing in the world is apple pie.
Oh, really?
But it took me a very long time to learn how to roll out a pie crust.
Yeah, pastry is difficult.
I was at a cooking store yesterday, and they were selling a marble slab for $50,
nice.
And I almost bought it. I was like, that would make rolling out pie dough so much easier.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll go on the Great British Baking Show?
I can't.
Why?
Because apparently you can't go on there if you have had published material.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I've like ruled myself out.
Would you have applied otherwise?
No, I'm nowhere near good enough to compete on that level. I think that baking isn't actually my favorite thing. It was quite a struggle for me to write all the cake recipes, because I'm not traditionally not a baker.
Well, they say there's two kinds of cooks. There's like the kind that likes to do savory cooking, where it's like a pinch of this, a drop of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm much more of that.
Because you're impetuous.
Yeah.
You don't like rules. Okay, we've got somewhere psychologically. Well, so I did want to make sure that we don't miss the period between Barcelona and now your current life. Were there other major milestones in there? I mean, in terms of jobs that you had and things that you did? You worked in marketing.
Yeah, I think that the big moment for me in the last kind of 10 years, I suppose, like the end of my 20s. So the book really is about when you kind of strip it all back, the book is about going home.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that thing we all do when we want to run away and we want to go see the big lights of the big city and travel and just get out there. And then I think in your maybe like your early 30s, you start reevaluating life a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I certainly kind of started looking back, and I look back at where I'm from and I'm like, it's beautiful. Like, it's so green. It's just nature, like full of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously my family are there and they've been there for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, it's actually pretty awesome where I'm from. It's very, like you said, it's like, it's a romantic kind of like.
That's place. A funny thing that you do go through when you get older. I mean, it's my equivalent is not loving where I'm from because my parents live in Florida, which is kind of a crazy state. But I think for me, it's more about my mom being a character. Mm-hmm. I have like a larger than life Jewish mother who's been a guest on this podcast. And she, you know, she would drive me crazy in my 20s. But then as I got older, I was like, oh, she's a character. Like, it's sort of like I can go back mm-hmm. to that and appreciate it.
Yeah, you as can I kind get of older. Look at it as in a more, not critical is not the right word. It's more of a kind of like, I suppose you've just got life lessons under your belt, haven't you? And you can be a bit more assertive in the way that you're like, oh yeah, that I, you know, I read you. This is who you are and you're.
What were the things though that made you want to leave Somerset? Like what did make you not feel comfortable there or happy there?
One of the things was that living village life, which is, you know, there are a mere few hundred people where I'm from.
Like, really?
It's really tiny.
Everyone knows everybody?
Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody else's business. And I remember, you know, there would be things that would happen. And then before you know it, it kind of got reported back to you via a third, fourth, fifth party quicker than it.
Really?
If you just,
did that like, happen with you being gay? Like, did somebody figure that out? And like,
get... Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Like the whole village knew before I knew.
So, really?
Yeah.
They saw you traipsing through the orchards, listening and to Kate
all,
Bush.
And... Yeah, all chatting. Yeah, exactly. so that was one thing that kind of like a very small world that actually I love, like now looking back, but, back then it was very suffocating as a teenager and a young person. The other thing, I just wanted to see other things. Like I've been to London a couple of times, never been there for an extended period of time.
You've been where?
London, sorry.
Oh, London, yeah.
I had visited as a child and a teenager a couple of times and was mesmerized by it and just always wanted to go there and always wanted to experience living there. And then also living in a rural area. So there are like, you know, all of these urban areas around me, like Bristol and Exeter and places like that. And I always wanted to just kind of see something that was bigger and different. And yeah.
And where in London do you live now?
I live in Stratford, which is where the Olympics were held in 2012.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. So East London. Yeah.
Okay. I was in London a couple of years ago and I went to Ottolenghi's shop in Notting Hill.
Yes. Beautiful.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah, the meringues there are incredible.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, everything. So yeah, just his presentation. I feel like he hit upon something that was like, there was a desire for whatever it was that he created and then he created it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. He, his whole team are amazing. Like he's, if you like read through his books, he's so humble about talking about the other people behind the Ottolenghi brand, I suppose, who make it work. And I love the fact that in every single one of his books, he will co-write it with like Helen, for example, who helped him with his suite, and other people. So yeah, it's very special.
So, okay, when you cook, so I have this book, I'm going to be devouring it after you leave. I can't do it now because it'd be very rude. But like, what is like a typical like meal that you'll just make at home with Pip?
Well, so we will roast your chicken.
Okay.
Which generally happens quite a lot.
How do you roast your chicken?
We have many ways, but there's a recipe in Diana Henry's book, which... Oh, it's actually adapted from elsewhere and she references who it is and I've forgotten, which is a really basic lemon and thyme, I think it is. And she roasts it upside down for 20 minutes. And then you turn the oven down and you roast it on the other side and it makes a really juicy breast, which is great.
This has come up a couple of times because people on this podcast have done Marcella Hazan's.
Oh, that's chicken. It. Yes, exactly.
That's hers
is adapted from that recipe.
Oh, yes. I have to make this now. This is the third time it's come up on the podcast.
It's amazing. It's the perfect way to roast a chicken and it guarantees juicy meat every single time.
Okay.
The one thing I would say if you do it is don't skip the drying of the skin because if you don't dry it, then it'll stick to the bottom and then you lose that lovely crisp. crispy skin, which is my favorite bit. So
wow. Okay, so you'll roast the chicken.
Yeah.
What else will you guys do?
So there'll always be we're quite healthy. Like when we're at home, we do eat out quite a bit as well. So when we're at home, it'll be, you know, there'll be a roasted chicken or meat. Maybe some fish or something, and then a section of vegetables. So it'll be quite healthy. We also, he writes about food, so gets sent tons and tons of cookbooks, which is amazing. He has an awesome cookbook collection. So we'll always be cooking from somebody's book that's about to come out or is he knows. So.
So you guys are side by side in the kitchen cooking together on a regular basis?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. If not,
Craig was in my kitchen last night and he was driving me crazy. I was like making Caesar salad and I was pouring the oil into the food processor and he was like, that's a lot of oil. And I was like, get out of here. Don't stop watching me cook.
Yeah, we don't. Some nights it will just be like one of us will just take over and you know, depending on who's going to be home first or whatever. But I don't mind him in the kitchen. It's quite fun.
How would you differentiate your styles of cooking? I mean, do you both approach food exactly the same way or?
No. So he doesn't actually eat dairy, which is quite a challenge for me because I put butter in everything.
Sure. As you should.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, dream thing. So my food traditionally is much more kind of heavy on the butter, heavy on the fats and stuff like that.
So he can't eat the food that you make when you do that?
When I do that, he can't. Yeah. So when we cook together at home.
As a therapist, I would say that's a hostile gesture.
It's for a good reason. So I know, I'm like, I'm just teasing. Okay. But sometimes I'm like, there are times actually when I'm like, I'm just going to cook that thing. Or like pudding actually is the real big moment because he'll be like, oh yeah, I can't have sticky toffee pudding.
I'm
like,
have you ever seen the movie The War of the Roses with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner?
No.
It's about a couple that like hates each other and they try to like basically at the end like they're trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
And there's a beloved dog in the family and she's feeding him pate and he's like, where's Sparky? And she's like, enjoying your pate. But then it turned, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but okay. She didn't actually kill the dog, but it's a great movie. I just thought of that with butter for some reason.
But like, we have, so our dogs will be the cats. So I have a cat and he also has a cat. His cat called Jennifer and
called she, Jennifer. So
yeah,
you did it again.
Called Jennifer. I know. Oh yeah. Sorry. and she is a demon for chicken and for any form of meat or fish or anything we're cooking, so she'll be kind of scrabbling at whatever trying to eat.
I want to go. I feel like I'm inviting myself to your wedding and I'm inviting myself to your house.
Come over to London, meet the cats and we'll cook you a dinner.
Well, we are nearing the end. We're not quite at the end, but do you feel like we've covered like the major big, you know, milestones of your life?
Yeah, I think so. I think yeah, the big one for me, it was a couple of years ago when I kind of, just before I got the book deal, when I was thinking about what I wanted to do and a book and kind of forming the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big moment for me. And then obviously when I pitched out and it got picked up by a publisher, was just like, oh wait, this could actually change quite a lot. And it could mean that I could do something that I've wanted to do for a long time. So
what's the goal next? I mean, would you want to have your own show on the BBC? Would you want to have another cookbook?
I'd love to do another book. So this book is all about, for me, looking back, not backwards, but looking back home and revisiting where I'm from at home. The food style in there is very much of that ilk, in the sense it's kind of like warming, hearty, homely home cooking. What I cook at home is much more kind of like, can be much more kind of maybe Middle Eastern vibes, Moroccan style sometimes, and I'm much more adventurous in the kind of cuisines that I cook at home. So I'd like to maybe my next book to be more perhaps about me right now, mm-hmm. as opposed to like looking backwards. So I would love to do another one, and I'd like to do one that's like the food that I'm cooking right now in my kitchen.
Would it involve Pip too? Would he like be in the book, like in the background?
I think he'd definitely have to, because in this book, he actually came to one of my shoots as well.
Uh-huh.
So we went on location down to Somerset, and we were shooting in this orchard, and it's the picture on the back of the book actually. And it's this big long table, and it's styled by him. He did all the styling.
It's beautiful. You can't see it, but it looks gorgeous.
When we did the acknowledgements, he wasn't put down as a stylist.
Oh no. And how did he handle that?
He was not happy. But luckily I put a note in the thank yous to him, and acknowledged the kind of work that he put into this book as well as everybody else. So I think if I did another one, he'd have to be in it, because he'd have to be acknowledged in the acknowledgements, and he'd have to Yeah, probably be featured in that.
Does he comment on your plating, like when you, because he's into design?
This is one thing we definitely agree on. Stroke grumble about is that I cannot make food look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Not a skill. Like I've thought of myself. I've tried to do it. I've tried to look at the Instagram pictures.
Yeah.
I've tried to, you know, finesse it so that it looks beautiful. I just can't do it. It looks like slop.
But he can.
But he can make it look amazing.
This is your book.
Yeah. So
no, seriously,
can style it.
But that's a great book because I can't make food look beautiful. But if you showed that process of like how he takes what you cook and then makes it look beautiful,
yeah.
I feel like that's a book.
Oh, that's a good idea. I might steal that.
Oh, yeah, do it. I just want 10% of the royalties. Well, we're at the end, but I'm going to ask you at the end of every podcast I started with, what did you have for lunch?
Yes.
I think you see where this is going.
Yeah, yeah.
But what are you having for dinner tonight?
So tonight we are going to a restaurant called Kismet.
Oh, it's wonderful. You're doing great.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, you're hitting all the best places.
How do you pronounce it?
Kismet.
Oh, it is Kismet. Okay, yeah. I thought I was doing that wrong. So we're going to go there tonight, which I think might be similar food ended up having for lunch. So
right. Oh, was he with
I'm not bothered. Yeah, he was here. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No. Is he like circling the neighborhood in a car right now? Waiting?
No, he's gone to the gym.
Oh,
yeah, it's one of those.
Oh, I get it.
So,
okay.
He's gone to the gym, but, so we're going to go there for dinner. And the one place I'm flying to New York tomorrow Yeah. And the one place that we had booked in to go to, but we actually missed it because they booked us really late was, is it Bavel or Bavel?
Bavel.
Bavel.
All these places you're going are all Middle Eastern sort of food.
Yeah, so yeah. This is it. We love that. And he took me to Tel Aviv a couple of years ago for my birthday.
Okay.
It was like the first holiday we did together. And I completely fell in love with the food there. So it's probably just still from that.
Still there. So Kismet tonight. Yeah,
Kismet tonight.
Kismet's really great. It's a cool atmosphere.
Cool.
The food's really good. It's interesting. LA has this thing where some restaurants that are very hip mm-hmm. will charge you a lot of money for a very small portion of food.
I can't stand that.
Well, get yourself ready. I mean, like, it's not like the most abundant food, but you leave feeling good.
Okay, we went to Adame. Is it Adame?
Oh yeah, I haven't gone there yet.
Yeah, really nice.
That was good.
Really lovely. Yeah, well, they served us like whole chicken, so I was very happy.
How did you know all these places? What did you look at? How did you find all this? These are all really good places.
So we...
Like Adame is even like, I haven't even been there yet and I live here. And yeah, that's like the coolest restaurant.
It's only just opened, I think.
I know.
It was really cool. What did we do? So we have friends who live here. So they obviously gave us some advice. He's just kind of like plugged in a little bit and just hears about things. Right. And also I have to say we looked at Eater as well and scrolled through the recommendations on there. So.
That's what I've been doing for Tokyo. Although it's so intimidating because Tokyo, it's like you have to the whole thing is like the hardest to get into restaurants are like the ones where they don't even take reservations. You have to know somebody who knows somebody. I'm forget about it. I'll just get like sushi at like the 7-Eleven or whatever.
Yeah.
Because people do that there and it's just like easier.
Yeah.
Well, James, I should tell everyone the name of your book is called Apple Recipes from the Orchard by James Rich. And it's a beautiful book, a perfect holiday gift.
Thank you.
For Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever holiday you celebrate. And it was so nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. It was really good to meet you too.
Thank you for letting me do therapy on you.
Thank you.
All right.